All right. Well, we have one more session, abbreviated though it be, and an opportunity to speak about a couple of short books. I hope you got a handout as you came in. If you did not, it's sitting in the back somewhere. If you can quietly go back and get one. We want to talk about Ezra Nehemiah in this session. And let me begin by just mentioning, there's a lot of literature out there on this. Let me mention one essay on the two books of Ezra Nehemiah that I find particularly helpful. And that's by Doug Green, who teaches up at Westminster Seminary. In this book, A Complete Literary Guide to the Bible, edited by Leland Ryken and Trimper Longman. I think I've mentioned this book before in this class. But Doug Green's treatment of Ezra Nehemiah, I think, is very helpful and gives a good orientation to it. Obviously, in David Howard's book, you have a lot of discussion of some technical questions as well as more general questions. So you've read that. This is Doug's treatment is more seeking the heart of the message of the book and the way in which the structure helps to communicate the message of Ezra and Nehemiah. And sometimes you'll hear me refer to Ezra Nehemiah as the book, because as you have read, there's a great likelihood that the two belong together. So just with that brief bibliographic notice on literature, we will move on then to talk about the book and give a general orientation to it. Doug Green, in his essay, suggests that perhaps the most basic strategy in reading is determining where a story begins and where it ends. In other words, if we can delimit the beginning and the end of a story, we have some sense of the middle. And those who deal with narratives often make the brilliant observation that narratives are characterized by having a beginning, a middle, and an end, which is, of course, highly enlightening. But if we can isolate the beginning and the end, we at least know what the composition is and what falls in the middle. So the question arises, are Ezra and Nehemiah part of Chronicles, or are they distinct? Are they two distinct books, or are they together a unity? These kinds of questions arise in particular because the end of Chronicles, which we read in 2 Chronicles 36, is a verbatim repetition, or is repeated verbatim at the beginning of the book of Ezra. And this is suggestive of the fact that the one is to be read after the other. 1 Chronicles, 2 Chronicles, then Ezra, Nehemiah. So it is clear, I think, that Ezra and Nehemiah, both historically and literarily, are meant to be the sequel to the book of Chronicles. But the question still remains, are they nevertheless independent works? Are they appendices to Chronicles? Were they written by the same author who wrote Chronicles? An older view was that Ezra wrote the book of Chronicles, and thus one would assume that perhaps he was responsible also for this other corpus, Ezra Nehemiah. Most scholars today would regard Ezra Nehemiah as being distinct literary works from the books of Chronicles, but the two of them together perhaps forming a single work. It is clear that in early Jewish tradition, the Ezra and Nehemiah were regarded as a single work. It was Origen in the 3rd century and then followed by Jerome in the 4th century who refer to two works, first Ezra, second Ezra, or Esdras. It was then the Vulgate that actually laid them out as two distinct works. And hence, the idea of dividing the two came into the Hebrew texts, the Hebrew manuscripts, not until the 15th century, as Howard points out, and as others obviously have observed. So it's, I think, best to think of Ezra and Nehemiah as a single work. And in that light, you might want to turn the page for just a minute to look at what I've put at the bottom here. Here's again one of my crazy little outlines that has some scientific and respectable portions to it, and then some other titles that really are intended only to help me remember what happens where. So you can make what you will of this particular outline. I will not be quizzing you on my particular version of what happens in these books. And there are even some uncertainties in my own mind as to exactly how to view some of these divisions. But it does seem that sources have been used in the compilation of the books Ezra and Nehemiah. And those sources, which most scholars have noticed, have been entitled the Book of Zerubbabel. Other titles are given, but that's really Ezra 1 to 6, where neither Ezra nor Nehemiah figure in those early chapters. But Zerubbabel is the chief character, among many others. But there's the Book of Zerubbabel, and then what some have referred to as the Ezra memoirs and the Nehemiah memoirs. And we have, sort of in this order, the Book of Zerubbabel in the first six chapters of Ezra, then the Ezra memoirs in chapters 7 to 10, then the Nehemiah memoirs in Nehemiah 1 to 6, or perhaps 1 to 7. You see on my outline, I think maybe the division should come after chapter 7, but I was, for other reasons, trying to keep things nice and neat and memorable. But to be quite accurate, it probably should end after chapter 7. And then the Ezra memoirs part 2 would then be chapters 8 to 10. Some people cut it off after 9, so there is some uncertainty as exactly how these differing sources, if in fact they had an independent existence, exactly where the boundaries are. And then we have a return to the Nehemiah memoirs at the end of the book, chapters 11 to 13, or perhaps 10 to 13. Now, as we go on and talk about the contents of the book, it'll make more sense of what I have on the right-hand side. Perhaps you can already figure it out from your own reading of the book, which deals with the temple, Ezra's wall, then the city walls, and then Ezra's wall again. And this is sort of patterned after Doug Green's discussion, which again draws on other discussions of the books that have taken place in the past. So it seems that sources have been used. Hill and Walton, in their very good introductory survey of the Old Testament, speak of, quote, the deliberate weaving or interleaving of the literary units by the compiler. And similarly, Shemar Yahu Talmon writes of three narrative units. Again, the boundaries between the narrative units are not clear-cut, in my view, and so we can be a little fluid in terms of where they come. But it does seem that because of first-person speech in some places, that in some places, as you read through these books, you probably noticed that sometimes Ezra seems to be speaking in the first person. Sometimes Nehemiah is using those first-person pronouns and talking about what he experienced or what he did. Now, one thing we need to notice about these books is the significance of the structuring or the patterning, the way in which the material is laid out. Doug Green observes that the author would have been constrained by his source material. He wasn't making this up. He was constrained by what he had before him. And so part of the propagation of the message which he felt these materials yielded was accomplished by the way in which the author structured the material, the way in which he put it together. The characterizations that, when we'll talk about that in just a minute, the characterizations of the different individuals are rather flat. You don't get a well-rounded picture of most of the characters. There is a sort of a clear-cut struggle, a clear-cut dualism between good and bad, between good and evil. And so that, too, is something to bear in mind, that probably the real situation was a bit more complex than this simplified version of good versus evil would have it seem. Now, so you have, on the one hand, the good leaders of Israel, your Nehemiahs, your Ezras, and you have your bad enemies, the Gentile nations, who opposed the rebuilding efforts. But in between stand the people, those who have returned, and they are potentially good or bad. So you have this nice dynamic of good, bad, and the people must make some choices. The people are being presented with a challenge. And that leads us then to a consideration of the message. The topic, on your outline I have topic and also theme, to give a topic and then a thematic statement. The topic has to do with restoration of the people to the land, and then separation of the people as the people of God from the surrounding nations and from the neighbors, from those who are already resident within the land. One of Doug Green's comments, which I think is so very helpful, is to recognize that Ezra Nehemiah is a story about the building of two walls. One, a physical wall around a city, and one, a more metaphorical wall around the people of God, a building of two walls. One was Nehemiah's wall, the wall around the city. The other was Ezra's wall, as he sought to circumscribe the people in such a way that they could remain pure as the people of God. So in terms of a thematic statement, I've written it on the outline there. You may be able to improve on this. But I simply say, as God graciously restores His people, they are to maintain a clear boundary between themselves and the unclean world. Obedience to God is the key. So as God restores His people, they are to maintain a clear boundary between themselves and the unclean world. And we'll want to reflect on what that means to us today as the people of God. Do we run off and join monasteries or convents or become hermits? What does it mean to be separate from the world? In terms of content, let's begin by looking at Ezra 1 to 6. If you look at my crazy little outline, you'll notice that I've tried to put this together in such a way that I can memorize it and remember its content. So it has silly little titles like God Touches Cyrus' Heart, Returnees Depart, Rebuilding Begins, Opposition Tries to End, Haggai and Zechariah, Re-excite the Building. So Haggai, Re-excite, Temple Done, Passover Bite, and I dare not allow more than that to be recorded. So I'll leave it to you to read it, but this kind of thing is helpful just to try to get a handle on the content. So I'm sure your outlines have already been composed and committed to memory, but if not, you may want to shorten the titles in such a way that you can try to grasp what's happening where. So the beginning of the book, Ezra chapter 1, begins with Cyrus' decree. And the question then arises, how does the account continue? We have, first of all, the returning of those who had been in exile, the beginning of the rebuilding, and then we have in chapter 4 opposition. And chapter 4 is very, very interesting. I hope you read in Howard his discussion of that particular question. You may want to turn to Ezra chapter 4 as we look at that for just a minute, because this is, again, is a fine example of the kind of thing that can be so confusing in our reading of the Bible if we don't know what's going on. In chapter 4, verses 1 to 5 deal with opposition that was brought against the building of the temple. And so this would be, according to Howard's dating, something that took place between the years 538 and 515, somewhere thereabouts. Okay. Then we come to verse 6, and it simply says, at the beginning of the reign of Xerxes, they lodged an accusation against the people of Judah and Jerusalem. And then verse 7, and in the days of Artaxerxes, king of Persia, Bishlam, Midrathah, etc., etc., I'm not going to try to pronounce all of those, his associates wrote a letter to Artaxerxes, and goes on and talks about further opposition. Now, some have been confused as they read this chapter, thinking, well, all of this is taking place within the same time frame. But the point I think we need to notice, and it's well put by Howard, so you can look back at that and read what he has to say there, is that the first five verses of the chapter deal with that time period, 538 to 515, whereas when we come to chapter 6 and following, we're dealing with two subsequent kings. One, Xerxes, also referred to as Ahasuerus in the book of Esther and in the Bible generally. That would be in the years 486 to 464. And then beginning in verse 7, we're dealing with the time period 464 to 423. So we're dealing with three different situations of conflict or opposition. And the description of the first simply triggers the summary by an author writing at a date after these events had taken place, triggers a description of the other oppositions which were similar. In other words, you want to hear about opposition? Well, let me tell you what went on during the days of Xerxes and during the time of Artaxerxes. Then it's not until verse 24 that we come back to the time frame in which we now are reading. And in verse 24 it says, "Thus the work on the house of God in Jerusalem came to a standstill until the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia." Okay, so we're back to the reign of Darius, which is where we left off at the end of verse 5. Okay, so we have kind of a parenthetical section in here which deals with oppositions which came later. Now you can see that if you don't understand that, that could involve you in considerable confusion in terms of trying to figure out who was involved when in this particular chapter. But this chapter anticipates something, some oppositions that come much later. Now, what is the effect of this? Why would a narrator have done this? Now, why not keep everything simply in sequential order? Well, Doug Green's suggestion is that the effect of this composition style, this bringing in these later oppositions, the effect of that is to expand the notion of what is meant by the house of God. See, the temple is being rebuilt. But by speaking of these later oppositions to something else that was being rebuilt, it expands the concept of the house of God to include more than simply the temple. Some of these oppositions were against the rebuilding of the city, rebuilding of the walls, 4:12 to 16. And so the house of God is not just the temple, but it's the city of God as well. And this expansion of the concept creates an expectation that will not be fulfilled until the time of Nehemiah, until the return of Nehemiah, which will be recorded later. The house of God cannot be completed until those walls, the city walls, are rebuilt. Okay. Any comments or questions on that? I think that's an interesting example of how the Bible can seem quite confusing until we understand what's going on. Once we understand what's going on, we say, well, yeah, that makes sense. Problem was mine, not a problem in the text. Yeah, Brian. Yeah, that's where the narrator's moving, particularly when he begins to talk about Ezra's wall, although the narrator never uses the term Ezra's wall, but it's clear, and we'll see that again structurally, that there is a focus on what Ezra is doing in terms of seeking to build a wall around the people of Israel, okay, and to keep them pure. That brings us to the next section, Ezra chapter 7, on to chapter 10, the end of the book, the first part of Ezra's memoirs. This introduces Ezra's wall, which will be continued in Nehemiah. We'll come back to this again in chapters 8 to 10 or 7 to 10 in the book of Nehemiah. Now again, what's the effect of interrupting these building projects? You know, you have the temple, and then later you're going to get the city wall, but right now, why would the narrator break up Ezra's memoirs? Why not just go ahead and give us Ezra's memoirs and then Nehemiah's, you know, in sequence like that, if that's in fact what we have? Why this interweaving of the source material in this way? Well, again, Green's suggestion is helpful. By placing this account of Ezra's activities, that is Ezra chapter 7 to the end of verse 10, in the middle of the narrative of the rebuilding of the temple and the city walls, the people's adherence to the law and specifically their separation from foreign wives becomes an integral part of what it means to rebuild the house of God. Which is exactly Brian's question, you know, which I forgot to repeat. But Brian's question was, is this expanding the notion of the house of God to include the people of God? Well, certainly, and this is how it's demonstrated. By Ezra's return in chapter 9, the lament over the way in which some of those who had returned had intermarried with foreign women. And again, let me stress, it's not an ethnic question. It's a religious question. Because these foreign wives, such as Solomon's wives, would have been worshipers of other than the true God. And so it was a religious question that needed to be resolved here. And so the concept of the walls and the house of God is expanded by this section then to include the people of God. Then we come to Nehemiah, the first six chapters, Nehemiah's memoirs, part one. And here again, the focus is back onto physical rebuilding. This time, Nehemiah in chapter 1 hears about the sad shape that the city of Jerusalem is in, the walls being in ruins. He is distressed. He is allowed to return, again by Artaxerxes. It was Artaxerxes who had allowed Ezra to return. Now he sends Nehemiah back. The rebuilding of the wall begins, but is met immediately by opposition. But the opposition is not able to withstand what is going on here. And so the wall is ultimately completed, and the physical reconstruction of the house of God is completed by the end of Nehemiah chapter 6, even though the wall will be dedicated. There'll be a reference to the dedication of the wall again in chapter 12. Having completed those walls, again we return to the focus on Ezra's wall in chapters 7 to 10. And here the focus really is on both Ezra's wall and Nehemiah's wall. The physical walls are now locked. They're barred for part of the time. And the question then arises, who can live within them? Who can live within now the city of God, which has been completed? The answer comes in chapter 9. Those who confess and those who commit to obey. And in chapter 9, there's this wonderful summary of the history of Israel. And if you're fuzzy on any of the broad outline of the history of Israel, this is not a bad place to review Ezra chapter 9, as you have an inspired rendition of Israel's history. A wonderful summary, which then leads the people to confession and to profess their allegiance in chapter 10. And these are the people then who become the house of God, who are recognized as the house of God and can live within that city. Now, that would be a nice place, I would think, to end the story, but that is not, in fact, what happens. We do have the final portion of Nehemiah's memoirs. In chapter 11, the city, for the first time in verse 1, is called the Holy City. Hasn't been called the Holy City prior to this. It is now holy. The walls have been rebuilt. The temple has been rebuilt. The broader goal of the narrative has now been reached, the building of the house of God, understood as the city where a people wholly devoted to the Lord lives. However, when we come to the last chapter, Nehemiah 13, we have a veritable litany of failures that are mentioned yet again, as if to say, to be continued, as if to say, the battle is not yet over. Yes, the city is rebuilt. Yes, the city is repeopled, but there will continue to be opposition. There will continue to be challenges which God's people must face. And so the original readers of this text would have been challenged to make their story a sequel in which they rise to the occasion and remove all doubts about the security and permanence of the house of God. That last quote is from Green again. So the people of God are challenged. The original readers would have been challenged, and I think we can be challenged to make our story a sequel, to rise to the occasion and remove all doubts about the security and permanence of the house of God. How do we do this? We'll come to that in just a minute when we talk about application. In terms of the structure and unity, there are many different attempts. I don't want to take the time right now to even give you one other than just this broad outline in terms of the source material that seems to be incorporated. Doug Green does make an interesting suggestion in his essay to which I refer you. There are other attempts that have been made. It does seem that there is a carefully worked out structure and that there is unity involved here, however we might want to work out the specifics of it. More important, I think, as we draw to the end of the time we have, is to ask two fundamental questions that we should always ask when we read biblical narratives, other portions of the Bible as well, but particularly narratives because we sometimes overlook them. And that is, what do we learn about God from books like Ezra and Nehemiah? Now, you've just read them, I hope. You were supposed to. What do you learn about God? What attributes of God, what qualities of God stand out to you from these books? Sometimes we get so transfixed by the goings-on with the human characters that we forget that primarily we're to learn from these narratives, as we said at the very beginning of this course, about God. And as we do so, then we learn something about ourselves. and what God expects of us, what God does for us, what God offers to us. What do we learn about God here? That God is faithful. We learn about God's faithfulness. Okay, God's mercy. Okay, His grace, His mercy. It would be nice to tag these with specific references in here. We don't have time to do that, but so we'll take these on faith. You're right, though. Yes, Dave? Okay, you really see His sovereignty in working through the Gentile kings, do you not? And His justice. All right, yes, Michael? You see that He's a covenant-keeping God in terms of continuing to deal with this people and to continuing to cultivate a people of God. I think overall, I mean, of the ones we've mentioned so far, I think I was struck perhaps most by His sovereignty. As reading through here, and I even began to underline sections that seem to deal with His sovereignty, beginning really with the first verse in Ezra chapter 1, the Lord moved the heart of Cyrus, king of Persia, and caused Cyrus to say, "The Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth." To cause Cyrus, at this juncture at least, to recognize God's sovereignty, that God had even given Cyrus these kingdoms. In verse 5, "Then the family heads of Judah and Benjamin and the priests and Levites, everyone whose heart God had moved, prepared to go up and build a house." And over and over and over again as we read through here, and don't worry, I'm not going to read them all to you, you do read about the God overseeing circumstances, touching people's hearts, putting into their minds a particular course of action, even into the minds of the Gentile kings, as Dave was pointing out. One that is particularly interesting, if I can just skip over a bunch of them and come to Nehemiah, begins to tie together the issue of this divine sovereignty, which is such an important attribute that we recognize in these two books, and the question of what do we learn about ourselves as human beings or other human beings. What do these texts teach us about human beings? When we come to Nehemiah chapter 4, we have that famous text, which I think has probably been the subject text of many, many sermons, chapter 4, verse 9. "But we prayed to our God and posted a guard day and night to meet this threat." It's such a wonderful sermon text because it kind of gives you two points: pray and post. You know, pray and post a guard. And so we learn from these kinds of books, as if we draw the right inferences from them, that the sovereignty of God does not mean that we just sit back and say, "Well, God is sovereign and He'll do it all and there's nothing much to be done." Praying is not the last thing we do when we've exhausted our efforts. It's the first thing we do. And then having prayed, we go forth in faith and do what God calls us to do. And in this instance, He calls them to pray and then to post a guard. God does work through intermediate causes or mediate causes, secondary causes. He doesn't just do everything presto as a magical act. And yet, He is sovereign. The prayer is primary. But then posting the guard is appropriate as well. What else do we learn about human beings? We could probably go on and on about what we learn about God, but we'll just highlight one or two. What do we learn about human beings from these books? Okay, human beings do not tend toward faithfulness. Okay, there is a temptation to fall back into sin. Perhaps the way the book of Nehemiah ends, again with a litany of failures, is suggestive of the fact that the human condition is such that we are prone to wander, we're prone to fall back into sin. We are faithless. Yet God remains faithful. Glory be to God. What else do we learn here? Yes. Right. Yeah, that was let me get this straight. That was actually Ezra. Okay, Ezra in chapter 8. That's a wonderful one when he says in verse 21, 22, "There by the Ahava Canal I proclaimed a fast so that we might humble ourselves before our God and ask Him for a safe journey for us and our children with all our possessions. I was ashamed to ask the king for soldiers and horsemen to protect us from our enemies on the road, because we had told the king, 'The gracious hand of our God is on everyone who looks to Him, but His great anger is against all who forsake Him.' So we fasted and petitioned our God about this, and he answered our prayer. And then as it goes on to verse 31, on the 12th day of the first month, we set out from the Ahava Canal to go to Jerusalem. The hand of our God was on us, and he protected us from enemies and bandits along the way. So we arrived in Jerusalem, where we rested 3 days. Now, here's a situation which maybe is a good balance to the one we were just looking at in Nehemiah about praying and posting, where Ezra realized that the honor of God would be in some way diminished if he said, "We trust God, but wouldn't you send along some soldiers to protect us? You know, God will protect us, but if you don't mind." You know, and so there are times to step out in faith and to simply trust God. There are times, and here I would get off on a tangent, there are times when I think we as Christians in America today need to be more concerned with God's honor than our personal safety or happiness. I think so often we put ourselves in the forefront of our concerns and say, well, I will honor God and bring honor to His name when it's convenient, but when times get tough, or when life is too tough for me or too miserable to me, I'll do what I want to do, regardless of how His name is tarnished in the process. I think there's a challenge here. Ezra was probably scared, and he wouldn't have minded those guards, but he said, we were ashamed because of what it would have said about our confession that God will protect us. We would have shown we really don't believe that. Yes? Right, right. Good. Yeah, if I can compress that comment, a very good one, that Ezra really was rejecting the option of going to the world for help when Ezra had, you know, the people had said, our God is sufficient, our God will protect us. And so he was hesitant to go to the world for help, whereas Nehemiah was praying and then stepping out in faith and doing what God perhaps called them to do in posting a guard. They were doing what was their duty as God's people, not necessarily going to the world for help. Okay, any other points? We've kind of gotten into application here already. Yes, Mark. Yeah, at this stage, being at this stage in biblical history. Yeah. Yeah, the question is, do we have at this stage in Ezra, Nehemiah, in their day, do we have a nation of Israel back in the land? I'm not sure that that's a question that I can answer, because the situation is that the conquering king, as often would happen in the ancient Near East, was allowing a conquered people to go back and repopulate and rebuild their land. But exactly what their status was as an independent nation is still in some doubt, because they were returning at the permission of the king who had conquered them. So whether they were coming back as a tributary state or whatever, I'm not sure. They had a governor. They didn't have a king. And so in some ways they did not have all the accoutrements of a fully formed national state at this time. Yeah, the focus is on the those who had returned from the exile of the southern kingdom, and that was primarily Judah, with neighboring tribe of Benjamin, and also a remnant of the northern tribes who had fled south and become part of Judah and then been taken into exile. Yes. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, the comment, that's, again, a good observation, that the threat was, well, those who were opposing rebuilding efforts were going back and reporting to the king who had given permission for the returnees to return, that a kingdom was being established, and the comment was always made, don't you remember what a rebellious kingdom these folk are, and do you really want to let this happen? So that is suggestive of the fact that it was something in the making, and really what was being reestablished was more the religious side of Israelite life, the cultic side. The focus was on the temple and not at all on the palace. There was no king to indwell a palace or anything. So the focus really is more on the religious rebuilding in both of these books. And we're not given any real evidence, as far as I know, as to what the precise national intentions of the political leaders were that had returned. Yeah. Any others? Our time has officially elapsed. So please remember, we'll stop here, and thank you for your patience in these late night sessions, and I will see you next week.